So the title of my presentation here is How Do Moths Find Their Sugar? And something I've been dabbling with for a number of years. And I want to start with, of course, with a little bit of introductory material for those of you who don't work with moths, which is probably most of you, not all, no, most. I know a couple of you do. You might ask the question, moths and sugar, what the heck is that all about? And there's some older literature, right? I keep having a habit of going back to things before World War II and DDT for interesting information on biology and behavior. But there's quite a bit of somewhat anecdotal information that's summarized in this paper by Norris, for instance, on butterflies and moths, but feeding at a lot of sources that are sugar-rich, with the assumption being that they're after sugars from things like fruit saps and flowers. And then there's also quite a bit of work early on in the last century, and then some more recently, on baiting or trapping moths with sweet baits or sweet materials. Again, the assumption is if they're attracted to these sweet materials that they're after sugar, but I want to keep making the point that when it comes to quantitative data, that actually what are they acquiring is really, really limited. So if anybody wants to research that, it's pretty much wide open for a lot of these insects. And then generally, I think that's the basis of where I'm going is the assumption or the hypothesis that they visit these sources to feed principally on sugar, not to negate the possibility that there are other nutrients in there at the same time that benefit them. Okay, so why are we interested in, why am I interested in moths and sugar? One has to do with collecting of insects, moths, and that's a favorite pastime for some people with the few groups of moths that are colorful and visually appealing, like catocala or underwing moths, that don't come in really well to lights. And for a long time, collectors have used sweet baits as a way to find and collect these moths. And in these photos here, you can't see it very well, but there's fermented brews that are painted on the sides of trees in the evening, and then you go back with a flashlight and find the moths somewhat intoxicated, feeding on these materials. There's are usually different recipes of home brews, not well published and not compared, so there's no optimization, just everybody's got their favorite. And I personally like overripe peaches, which I just throw in a blender, add sugar, and age it, and then go with that. So what's the other thing here of interest is trapping of moths with sweet baits. That's a fruit fly sort of a trap, but you can put fermented sweet materials in and catch lots of moths. That one on the bottom is for butterflies, but works for moths, that butterfly bait trap. And there are studies and there are uses there for looking at biodiversity and distribution and detection, or for looking at seasonal phenology and relative population densities. Not very many studies, but there's some out there and some potential. But what I go to is chemical attractants from those sweet baits for pest management, using those for monitoring and detection with traps, and hopefully lure and kill. Here's two examples. Use the mouse here. This is a photo out of Australia, and I've seen a couple of studies published on this now with moths that are fruit piercing on fruit or damaged fruit with sweet fruit materials with pesticide that they can access and then kills them. That's this one right here. And then following Everett Mitchell's past work in Gainesville, Florida, I've been doing work here with this kind of I call it a station with a lure. The moths come in, contact that, and get pesticide on them and get killed. Just different strategies there. And I'm going to fairly quickly here go through some examples to give you an idea of where we're at with this work. One is cabbage looper moths attracted to flower odorants, and another is alfalfa looper moths attracted to flower odorants. Cutworms, and by cutworms I'm pretty broadly speaking of noctuid moths and several subfamilies attracted to chemicals from fermented molasses solutions, and then codling moths attracted to some chemicals from overripe pears. So cabbage looper, this is one of the more well-studied and goes back quite a ways, but it's a heavy visitor on flowers, really obvious on flowers at dusk. And we've got work here done on honeysuckle, that's night blooming jessamine, Abelia araugia, and this more than one species of gora. I want to make the point here that in this case, these are all have tubular corollas, you know, which might be related to being flower visited, not bee visited, because you've got the ability with the proboscis of the moth to get down in there to get the nectar. All of them are brightly colored, and the moth here, the cabbage looper, does fly at, and you can see them feeding at dusk, and it's they may have a visual component to that behavior. All right, and we do know, we've got, you know, good studies and data that the cabbage looper visits these flowers, that they're attracted to the flower odorants. And a lot of volatile collection work has been done on a number of these. This just is a particular system that Bob Heath put together, that I show this one because he's here, right? Otherwise I'd use one of my own. And this is a night blooming jessamine plant. So essentially what you've got is glassware housing one of the branches with flowers, with filtered purified air being pushed in and then air being pulled out over a super Q filter, so that you can trap the odorants from the flower onto the super Q for chemical analysis. There's also work that's been published on washing the flowers or extracts of flowers, which can make things still get you the compounds, but doesn't tell you really what's released. And then there's work done on the cabbage looper moths here and their attraction to synthetic chemicals that are isolated and identified from the flowers, and flight tunnel assays and field tests using traps to back that up. So this is fairly thoroughly worked out for cabbage loopers on those different plants. And what we've got to here with the chemicals is phenylacetaldehyde has been known for some time and a major flower odorant. Here's a couple of references that go back a ways. And then there's Ken Haynes' work with Abelia and phenylacetaldehyde, benzaldehyde, 2-phenylethanol, and benzyl alcohol. And Bob Heath's work with the night blooming jessamine, that's the genus Cestrum, with phenylacetaldehyde, benzyl acetate, and benzyl aldehyde. And then work by Sam Pear on honeysuckle, cisjasmine, linalool, and phenylacetaldehyde. And that lastly, Juan Lopez with you got overlapping chemicals, but that list right there. And sort of the wrap-up point of that is there's quite a few different compounds that have been implicated with a theme of a small number that are broadly overlapping. So the alfalfa looper, a similar related moth, but in the western United States, including Reno, I saw three dead ones in the stairs at the pepper mill. When I thought it would be good exercise to walk the 14 flights up, boy, did I have a bad knee burn when I was done. Okay. And so we've done some work in Yakima on the butterfly bush, which is known to be visited by butterflies, but if you stay out there long enough, you get moths coming into it. And also Oregon grape, which is heavily visited by alfalfa loopers very early in the spring when the moths are flying in March and in April. So a lot of the same kind of work is done on that. We use this Heliothis trap over flowers just to get data and document what is visiting the flowers and then can get trapped when they leave. The same thing with Oregon grape flowers and plants. And alfalfa looper, and then on both of those is the most dominant visitor. And if you go later in the season with butterfly bush, it's the cabbage looper and the alfalfa looper. We don't see cabbage loopers in the spring in Washington. And then here's another one of these systems that we've got on a cart to go outside with a couple hundred feet of electrical cord to power it to collect volatiles off of these plants. And what we wound up there, again, is a list of compounds. These are the ones off of Oregon grape. And then I've put a pound sign here next to the three we have behavioral evidence for with the alfalfa looper: beta-myrcene, benzaldehyde, and phenylacetaldehyde. And then with the butterfly bush, a lot of other compounds. And here, we don't have the behavior and the trapping to the chemicals because I don't yet have a source for three of these that we're interested in, these oxoisoferone compounds. But we've got EAD activity, we've got the alfalfa looper is the pound sign here, and the cabbage looper is the asterisk. So benzaldehyde and these, the oxoisoferone, the dihydroxoisoferone, and the oxide of that. I don't know how, but I'd really like to get to the behavioral test with that. So it gives you kind of an idea of the chemistries, but I don't like the idea of putting like 15 component blends out there and finding out what they'll do because it sounds so impractical. So we did a lot of work figuring out small numbers of compounds in blends that where we can trap these using like release devices like this cap, the bottle, and using the universal moth trap, and getting lots of data sets, and much of this is published, you can find in the literature, for alfalfa looper and cabbage looper. Typically what I've been doing is doing single component tests where we put one chemical at a time in a dispenser. Phenylacetaldehyde is really strong all by itself. In this particular case with alfalfa looper, beta-mercene is also attractive but pretty weak. But when you put it together, this is scaled down, right? Here we've got like 45 and here we're up to 100. So that's phenylacetaldehyde, and then this is poorly labeled. This is, the control is nothing, phenylacetaldehyde, and then all of these are phenylacetaldehyde plus the second chemical. So that's not alpha-pinene, that's phenylacetaldehyde and alpha-pinene, and then the same with adding beta-pinene. So here you get a big jump up when you take phenylacetaldehyde and you add beta-mercene to it. So there's been quite a few of this stuff trying to pin down what are the best lures that are comprised of a small number of compounds. And then we've got work going to lure and kill. That's like I showed this earlier with this device where we've got a bottle releasing the fluoroodor and the moths come in and touch this and pick up pesticide that's painted on the inside of this badminton birdie. And we found through a school, local school contract, that we could get vast numbers of these badminton birdies very cheaply instead of going to a local store. And I'm sure somebody can commercially make something like that even more cheaply. To give you an idea of the kind of data that we got on that, this is in a field without those badminton birdies, and this is in a field with the badminton birdies, and the numbers of moths that are indicated by traps is very different all the way through there. But in parallel to pheromone track and kill, I always worry about how much of that is evidence the moths are gone versus how much is evidence of disruption. So we did work here, this is mainly Leo Camilo's thesis work, on track and kill in a screen house where we put plants in, release moths so they could lay eggs, and then set up an experiment to interfere with them laying eggs with two of those badminton birdies with the floral lure in it. That's two attract and kill stations per screen house, 100 potted lettuce plants, and we got this big reduction in eggs. And what we've got here is these are moths released in that screen cage with no attract and kill, and over here is how many eggs are laid on the plants if we left those two attract and kill stations in there, and it's a very, very severe knockdown that's evidenced before they can lay eggs. So we put mated females in, and I think they go down the first night. So this is an added treatment that's really intriguing and very important. If we fed the moths sugar water before we released them, we did not get this big knockdown. So that I'm interpreting that to mean that they weren't hungry and rapidly laid eggs before they were interested in going to the floral lure. So that's a concern in field work. Okay, now switching gears to that third example, cutworm moths, and this is kind of a scattering of moths that I think are beautiful and other people think are ugly, of noctuids, that we have good responses to these chemical combinations from molasses. And that work started with work on yellow jackets that came off of codling moth work. I think some of you have heard this before, but that started with molasses odorant chemistry for the yellow jackets, hornets, and paper wasps. And when we were doing that work, I wanted to know if the chemical combination of acetic acid and isobutanol was the optimum, because we find a lot of compounds with the molasses. So we tested acetic acid with chemicals that were structurally similar or close to isobutanol, which is right here, that's our strongest yellow jacket attractant. And there's a lot more data than this, but I didn't want to bore you. There's three sets like this that add up to, I think it's 22 different compounds. But of interest here is 3-methyl-1-butanol is, it jumps things up a little bit from, this is acetic acid by itself, acetic acid with 3-methyl-1-butanol for yellow jackets. But more interestingly was all of those traps filled up very quickly with noctuid moths. Very difficult to sort out in a wet trap, and all the scales fall off, and it's hard to tell what they are. But that was, I moved with that to three pests that we have in our area in orchards. Lacanobia subjuncta, which was defoliating apple trees at the time. Spotted cutworm, that's blamed for a lot of problems, but I don't think is. And Bertha armyworm. And we know that we can trap them with molasses. And then we did find they respond really well to this chemical combination of acetic acid and 3-methyl-1-butanol. And that's those three moths. And an example of a data set here on trapping is you have an unbaited trap, an acetic acid trap, 3-methyl-1-butanol trap, and then you get an enhancement when you put the two of those together for all three of those, Lacanobia subjuncta, Bertha armyworm, spotted cutworm. And then that's expanded since then to a lot of other moths, both targeting pests, but also biodiversity kinds of studies with non-pests. So this is just a short list of an example of where we've got a lot of data on pests responding, the glassy cutworm, which is a pasture grass feeder, the clover looper, the two we were working with here, the true armyworm, the hops looper, which might mean nothing to you unless you're a good beer drinker, but Yakima grows a lot of hops, a really high percentage of hops for the world. And then three cutworms and the meal snout moth. So this is still sort of an expanding arena. And then I've been doing some biodiversity sorts of studies. Right now I'm working in a nature conservancy site, but here's an example in 1999 where we were just looking in a natural area of what we were picking up. So you get, you know, these are numbers of species. And then in Alaska with Alberto Parentoia back there, where there's a comparison here of the two types of lures, the floral lure for the loopers and this lure for the cutworms. And you see, I'm going to make just a couple of points out of this. With geometrids, we consistently catch a lot more species with the floral lure, not very many with the acetic acid, 3-methyl-1-butanol. For some of these noctuid subfamilies, amphiprines, curculiines, and noctuines, they're generally much more attractive to this one and poorly attracted to that one. And the plusiines, that's where we get our loopers. Not very many species in Alaska, but exclusively to the floral lure. And I want to show some numbers which show the same thing. Oops, did I jump two? I did. Actually, I jumped five. How did I do that? Okay, here we go. So here are just numbers, and that's even stronger, where you get 7 geometrids and 116 geometrids, for instance, and then flip-flopping the other way with these amphiprines, 83 versus 946, and the loopers, 15 to 0. So those are just interesting taxonomic patterns. We'd like to relate more to where they're getting sugar in nature, but there's not much information out there. So and now the last one here, the calving moth, this started with Doug Light's work discovering the pear ester, which is a really strong chiromonal lure for the codling moth, and a lot of developmental work has been done on that lately. And one of the things that I was intrigued about with this is some anomalies with the information that was coming out. So this pear ester is ethyl EZ 2,4-decadienoate. It's a pear volatile, and it's you can trap moths, lots of moths with the compound, males and females, and there's some questions here about the role of attraction of the pear ester and the behavioral ecology of the codling moth. It's not emphatically stated in the literature, but in meetings and talks, the idea was the hypothesis that it's an overposition attractant because from the host fruit, moths respond to locate overposition sites. But there's some issues there because you catch a lot of males, and males aren't laying eggs, but you can imagine why a male would go to an overposition site. But also unmated females and senescent females with no eggs are attracted to it. And also we found that with three varieties of fruit, that it's only emitted by pairs very, very late in the season after most or nearly all oviposition is over. And I've been working with four varieties of apples and haven't yet found it at all in apples. So that raises the question, what's this got to do with the behavior of the moth in nature? And because I'm already working on feeding attractants and sugar, of course I go right to that. And also, people where I work know that I've got this addiction to Snickers bars, which has something to do with the same problem. But I thought that collie moths might be attracted to ripe fruit and the pear aster in part as a food-finding response to get sugar off the surface of the fruit, because when it's really ripe, you get yeast and bacteria on it, and they might be able to access sugar. So we set up experiments to look at the combination of acetic acid as a fermentation, microbial fermentation product from sugar, which is well known and goes way back. And we already knew that you can trap codling moths with acetic acid. And this is an example of, back to molasses, that you can explain most of the codling moth response to molasses by their response to acetic acid. So I took a look at the combination of acetic acid from that we would hypothesize is from microbes and pear ester from very ripe fruit as co-attractants for codling moth seeking sugar, and use trapping experiments. So you use no lure and acetic acid lure, pear ester lure, and a combination lure. And in that, actually, I've done different kinds of traps. And the first round, we put the pear ester in septa and the acetic acid in these little polypropylene bottles with a hole in it. I'm now working with the two of them all mixed up together, and that works just fine. I thought maybe there'd be some interaction or breakdown, but there doesn't appear to be. And this is we got a lot of data sets like this. This particular one, Max Suckling helped me with in New Zealand. So you look here, if I can get the mouse to work. Nothing in the control, a weak response to acetic acid, a pretty good response to pear ester, and then you get, with the females and the males, a good enhancement of response to that. So that's really interesting and possibly useful. So that's another local trap set. And I know Alan Knight, for instance, right now is using that combination with homeowners to try trapping out in combination with different chemicals and see how well that'll work. So that gives you four examples of where we're at with some of this work, going from ideas over what the moths are doing through isolation and then on to what you can do with compounds. And then good time for a wrap. So I want to make the point here that it does look like many moths find sugar by chemical cues associated with sugar, although I'd like a lot more information on the actual sugar feeding and changes with physiology and behavior with sugar work. We've got a little bit of that we're doing. And we have several chemical attractants that look to me to be pretty strong for female and male moths that should be useful to lure pest moths or non-pest moths, like in those biodiversity studies. And we're just now beginning to learn how to use these for detection, monitoring, and pest management. So with that, I think we got time for questions,
yeah.
Hal? All right, well, thank you. Tom?
This gets to what you said you maybe don't know enough about, but naively, how long do some of these adults live, and how good is a sugar meal for them? Do they lay more eggs afterwards?
Okay, yes, so we've got two examples that go to all the people that work with me. I have to say that because there's some sitting in the back of the room again. I don't actually do anything, right? You remember that. All right, so with the cabbage looper, there's a lot of work that was done, and that was by Ken Ward that worked with me on adding to fecundity and longevity, and the fecundity increases were massive. I mean, and that's a moth that can live for quite a while if you take care of it. The same with the codling moth, there's definitely an effect, but it's nowhere near as dramatic with the cabbage looper. So that's where the data is anyway. With the codling moth, that's Eric Wenger. I don't think he's in here. Is he here? Okay. All right, there he is. Do you mind if I speak for you here, Eric? Yeah. I'd say he was disappointed and how long that they lived because he couldn't get them to die. So, I mean, we had, I don't know, what were you out to, like 30, 40 days? Yeah, and my assumption before that was that out in the field, I would expect a moth to emerge on one day, mate the next night, dump out 80% of the eggs on the third night, and then, you know, then you're pretty much looking at things going downhill.